This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, good evening. Thank you for coming. This evening we're going to look at my grandfather's view on a Jewish sexual ethics, which is based on one article that he wrote in a book called Crisis in Faith. We've seen excerpts from this book before. And we're also going to look a few excerpts at the end from another book called God, Man, and History that I think some of the pieces and conceptual ideas connect between the two works. The book Crisis in Faith was written in 1976. And in general, you can see from the title, right, this word crisis, he was writing about some of the challenges he felt that the Jewish people were facing in this time period, right? In the same book, there was already a chapter on the status of women that we looked at excerpts from. There was the article on conversion in that book. And in it, he also decided to write about Jewish view to sexuality. And specifically, and so you have to put yourself like in that time period, and he's going to mention it right here. At the beginning, he was talking about the sexual revolution that had happened clearly in the end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s. And he even talks about some of the slogans that he felt that were being sort of presented and people were trying to live up with, which had to do with self-fulfillment, personal freedom, liberation from the taboos of the past and obsolete laws. So that is one sort of, it's definitely, he's like sort of working with that in the background. He says it explicitly. I bought a small excerpt, but he spends a decent part of that article talking about it, and he quotes from Freud and all sorts of different psychologists and of the views of the day about sexuality, which it could be that from nowadays we might have moved past that a little, or some of the things are still relevant. The other thing that he's sort of dealing with within this text that we're going to look at is sort of the view. I didn't actually look this up when in science, but I assumed it was scientifically aware for quite a while, but that the universe is sort of unplanned, that it's just a random event that has no meaning, right, of a Big Bang. And so those two ideas he feels he has to speak out against, and that's basically what happens in this article. So that's a little bit of the background. I'll say one other thing about the article. He uses the word man over and over and over again, which is his word for human beings. I find that a little grating on the ear because to me the word man is gendered, but he is saying it as a human being word. So that's one disclaimer. The other disclaimer is that clearly, because he's basing himself on the traditional Jewish sexual ethic, he's talking about a sexual relationship between a man and a woman, and mostly within the context of marriage. So I'm putting that out at the beginning, that I'm acknowledging that those two things might not sit so well. I don't know where the audience is coming from in a modern ear. I still think that some of the ideas that are presented here, I hope, will be interesting and relevant. Okay. So, sure. Okay. So this is the first paragraph opens, right? Nowhere is the essence of the personal life as self-transcendence more manifested than the area of sex. The relationship between man and woman is the area most revealing about the condition of the human being. Nowhere is what we have described as the collapse of values more obvious than in the contemporary sexual revolution, right? This is a chapter in a book where he's talking about other collapse of values.
And
76, he's writing. That's when the book was published. I assume the material's written a slide before. And he spent some time, I didn't bring the quotes, talking about his understanding of what the Christian sexual ethic was, which he identifies a little bit with a degradation of the body. He quotes from Paul, who has a verse in which Paul says that best not to even touch a woman, and that sort of marriage is a b'diavad. Like, if you have to, then okay, get married. But that is looked at negatively. He talks about the repression and guilt that Freud talks about. And one of the main issues, and we're going to read a quote from that he talks about, is this idea of thinking of the human being as just an animal that has just instincts and drives and mostly is seeking pleasure. So if you look in the next paragraph where it says 49:50, it says, the emphatic affirmation that try as he might, man can never be anything but an animal, presents him with only one choice. He can either strive to become an ascetic animal, and since he will never fully succeed, he will be a neurotic. Or he can recognize himself fully succeed. Or he can recognize himself for what he is, a pleasure-seeking animal, and live accordingly. Right? He thinks that the values of the sexual revolution are stemmed from this idea that, well, man is only an animal. That is what the contemporary sexual revolution is all about. Man accepting himself as animal wishes to get rid of his neuroses. Now, right, so getting rid of his neuroses, I'm going to be free, I'm going to do whatever I want, I'm just going to embrace who I am. And so he goes on to say, now not all psychologists are Freudians who would accept Freud's metapsychology according to which man is fully comprehended by the pleasure principle. Yet all of them that dominate the climate of the age follow a metapsychology of their own, reduce what used to be considered the essence of man's humanity to an accidental derivative from his specific animality, is that even a word? Right, so this is going to be the thing that bothers him, this idea of just taking what was so unique about human beings and just say, an animal might be a high functioning, but an animal. Given this kind of meta-science and meta-psychology, which are uncritically accepted by a generation that they begat, the sexual revolution against all repression and inhibition is fully justified. Right? He said he understands within this background, if this is your view, what the sexual revolution is about. Right? On the basis of its premise, the resulting principle of a liberated sex ethic, that every kind of sexual activity and relationship between consenting adults is permissible, cannot be gainsaid, which means denied. I looked that up. No idea what it meant.
Good English.
Never heard of it in my life. So he says he understands, right? He understands the view of the liberated sex ethic, that if you're two consenting adults, you could do whatever you want, right? If the understanding is that you just have this drive and you're seeking pleasure and this is what human beings are about. But his premise is that is not a Jewish understanding, based on the fact of a belief that, A, God created the world, and so therefore there's meaning and purpose to the way the world functions, and B, that human beings are created in the image of the divine. And so that's what he goes on to say here. As with every other aspect of Judaism, a Jewish sexual ethics cannot be maintained meaningfully without an understanding of the presuppositions on which it is based. The statement that the world is a creation implies that all the vital forces in which human nature shares are present within man and carried into life through man have their place within the scheme of all things. Thus, human sexuality has its creator-intended function within the plan of creation. It is world-related, handed to man with a goal directed beyond the individual. Okay, so the purpose of this article is going to be to try to figure out what that is. But his belief is that if you believe that God created the world and the way the world functions, that God has an intended purpose for sexuality, and that it isn't just, an instinct. That God created man in his own image, that he breathed into his form the breath of life, is of course an uncompromising rejection of all meta-science and all meta-psychology, which reduce man to a mere member of the animal kingdom. But that man is not an animal is a Jewish affirmation that cannot be given up without surrendering Judaism itself. Okay, this is very important to him. Right? If you believe that human beings are created in the image of the divine, you can't say they're just an animal. Right? And to him, that is the core of Judaism. Man's humanity is not something derived, okay, here's another word, an epiphenomenon, right, which means a secondary cause or a byproduct of his animality. It is an originally given as his instinctual equipment and biological frame. Because of that, man's animality is too is human. Whereas the secularist of today animalizes the human, Judaism humanizes the so-called animal. Our great teacher Hillel considered caring for the body a mitzvah, a religious responsibility, because it meant looking after the divine image in which man was created. And so this idea is going to be very important to him, that the body itself is of equal importance to the spirit. We're going to see this itself, right? If we say that human beings are created in the image of the divine, then that there's value to the body and to the soul and to the, etc. He knows that. He'll say, here, we'll keep reading it on.
What did you say again? The phenomenon is?
A byproduct or a second effect, a secondary effect. Do people know that word? I did not. But that's what the dictionary said. Or not really the dictionary. The Google, what does this word mean thing. Okay. Notwithstanding all the theological problems of anthropomorphism presented by the concept, it is the whole man, body and mind, instinct and spirit, that was created in God's image, and as such, in his complex entirety, represents that image on this earth. Okay, so he knows that you could have philosophical, theological problems with this idea. He's not discussing them here, but his claim is that the image of God is represented both by human beings' body and by their spirit. And so the processes that the body goes through have to have meaning. Nor is this just teaching unrelated to man's self-experience. It is more than doubtful that the reduction of man does justice to his existential reality. The reductionist theories are contradicted by the daily behavior of the human being. Man not only desires instinctively, he wills, plans, chooses, accepts responsibility, and creates. In a public debate with a radical Jewish theologian, I do not know who this was, I induced him to clarify his goals for man. He wanted man to be a healthy animal. What he was unable to grasp was that it was impossible for man to be a healthy animal, for the simple reason that in order to be that, man has to make a choice, a decision. But no healthy animal, because it's a healthy, could ever want to be a healthy animal. Only a sick man would want to be a healthy animal. This view is at the core of everything he's going to say about sexuality. Right? He believes that we're created in the image of the divine, and therefore our behaviors and our actions and the way we treat the bodily functions have to be more than just, say, pleasure-seeking or just instinct. And so he doesn't want it to just be some primitive drive. Because of what man is, human sexuality cannot find its fulfillment in the simplicity of primitive satisfaction. As a rebellion against the repressionists and inhibitions of a society that has no spiritual, religious, or even philosophical basis for the sexual taboos, a return to primitive sexuality may have its validity. Right? It's interesting, he keeps saying, I understand the sexual revolution based on your worldviews and your philosophy. But because man is human and not an animal, primitive, purely biological sexuality is bound to leave him empty and wretched. Ultimately, a return to the purely biological is not open to him. The natural for man is never purely biological. It is always psychosomatic, or for use of, I don't know this person, but apparently he's famous because he quoted a number of times. How do I pronounce his first name? Ignatius? How do you pronounce it?
I pronounce it Ignatius.
Ignatius. Terminology, biopsychic. Back to nature can only mean back to human nature. Any other kind of return is unnatural. Okay, so he's very clear that he has a sense that human nature is different than animal nature. That is something that is at the essence. Let's just see if I want to read to you any more for this. He makes the claim that he knows that in the Torah there are certain bodily secretions that we say are impure. But what's very interesting is his claim is that... does he say this here? That only happens when they leave the body. Does he say that here? In other words, while there is indeed in the Bible some ritual laws regarding certain bodily secretions, the body as such is entirely pure. And as such, according to Sadi's understanding of Jewish teaching, I'm on 53. Going across. It just has to do with how I can fit them on the page the best. Sometimes I go down and sometimes I go across. But I want to try to save paper. Right? But even an appropriate companion for the soul on this earth. Integrating Sadi's view with the idea of the biopsychic unity that man is, we would say that the body is a body only in man's death, and just as a soul is a soul only after his death. In life, however, they are linked to each other in such a manner that they
interpenetrate.
That's a good... Because of this psychosomatic unity, a denial of either one of them is a betrayal of both. Within Judaism, man is acknowledged in his biopsychic reality. This is the basis of a Jewish sexual ethics. It excludes primitive biological sexuality as well as sophisticated asceticism. So this is his claim, is that you can't just have body and you can't just have soul, mind, thinking. The two are always going to have to be linked, both functions and both, and that's what's going to give meaning to life, okay? And he's going to talk about how that will play out in sexuality. Before he does that, he presents the fact, you might know some of these famous stories, that he acknowledges, right, he's making the claim that we're not animals and that we don't have a primitive drive. He acknowledges the fact that, of course, the rabbis know that we have a sexual drive and that that drive can sometimes overtake us and be very powerful. Right, he quotes, I won't read this inside, I'll tell you these stories outside, but you have them here. He quotes the premise that the rabbis say that there's in opitropos la'ariot, that there's no guardian against sexual misconduct, right? Meaning that the humans have a weakness for sexual pleasure. And then he goes and quotes a number of famous stories about the rabbis themselves and their challenge of overcoming this drive. There's a very famous story in Masachet Kiddushin of Rav Amram. I'm just summarizing some of the things that are said here if you want to look at them inside. He's just quoting the Gemara. Rav Amram, there was a number of group of Nehardian women who had been kidnapped and ransomed, and they were being sort of stored in the attic of Rav Amram's house. And he notices one of them and is attracted to them, and he desires her. And the Gemara says that he moves this ladder to try to climb up there that only, like, very heavy, 10 men could move. And as he's going up, he knows that he's doing something again, and he starts shouting, there's a fire in Rav Amram's house, there's a fire in Rav Amram's house, right? Implying the fire of his burning sexual desire, but he's screaming it because people are going to think there's a real fire, and they're going to come running to put the fire out, but by them coming, they'll stop him. And when they come, right, and so like there's this sort of tension between him unable to control himself, he's still moving, but knowing with his mind that he needs to control himself. And so then his neighbors come and sort of expose him, and he's able to sort of save his behavior through that, but you see the power of the desire. In the same Gemara, they tell two interesting stories where the Satan dresses himself up as an attractive woman, in one case to tempt Rabbi Akiva, in one case to tempt Rabbi Meir. The Satan is a beautiful woman. I'm not sure why she would do this, but she's on the top of a palm tree, and Rabbi Akiva starts trying to climb the tree to reach her. For Rabbi Meir, she's across the river, and he does this, like, this is the first Tarzan quote in the Gemara. He grabs a river and, like, grabs a rope to jump over the river to get to her, and it's only because HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to the Satan, because of their Torah learning, stop, that the Satan, like, disguise reveals itself, and they're saved from this sexual transgression. And so, and these stories are told to show you that even the greatest rabbis, right, have these drives and at times look like they can't control them. There's one more story of Abaye, which is kind of funny, that he overhears a man and woman saying, like, oh, we have to travel, let's walk together. And they're going out of the town, and they go off together. And he assumes that they're going to do some hanky-panky. So he decides he's going to follow them to stop it. I don't know, or to see. I don't know what he's going to follow. He thinks he's stopping, right? And finally they come to, like, a cross in the road, and then they say, okay, it was, like, nice going with you, and they separate, right? And he's totally embarrassed that he thought this, right? It's clearly what he would have thought about himself, and he's just desolate. And then an older man comes along and says to him that kol hagodel michavero yatzro godel himeno, like, the greater the man, the greater the yetzer, your sexual desire, right? So he's a great Talmud Chacham, and so therefore, and he's revived a bit by this idea. But it's clear that the rabbis themselves understand the power of sexual drive, and they understand that it's sometimes incontrollable. My grandfather does quote a number of cases where they understand also that it's important and it's good here. If you look still on page 2, in this column over here, I'll just read a bit. It says, the rabbis of the Talmud had nothing to learn from Freud regarding the tremendous power of the libido. Nevertheless, they had a very positive evaluation of its function. Rabbi Shmuel, the son of Nachman, for instance, comments on the words of the Bible that at the end of the creation, God saw everything that God had made, and behold, it was tov. Ma'od. It was tov, very good. Tov, good, that is the Yetzer tov, the good inclination of man. Tov ma'od, right, the drasha is on why does it have to say good and then very good, right? The ma'od is very good, that is the Yetzer hara, the evil urge in him. The question is, of course, asked, how is it to be understood? How is it possible to call man's innate inclination for evil very good? The Midrash responds, this is the Midrash in Bereshit Rabbah, this is to teach you that were it not for the evil inclination, for the Yetzer hara, man would not care to build a home for himself, he would neither marry nor beget children, nor would he attend to the affairs of human existence. What Rabbi Shmuel calls the Yetzer hara seems to be rather close to the Freudian libido or id. It is the vital energy that sustains the life of man, and is the source of sexual drive. Its function is necessary. Without it, human life would not be possible. Right, so there's an understanding that this thing that has a negative side that can be a Yetzer for the negative also has a very positive side that helps sustain life and motivates people to beget children, to form families, etc. Same idea is presented, if you flip the page on page 3, in another Midrash that I'll read right here. It says, the positive value of universal sexuality is maintained with a sense of humor in the following tale. On a, how do I pronounce that?
Propitious.
I didn't look that one up. I didn't even notice that one. What does propitious mean? What?
Good.
A propitious occasion. The Jews asked for merciful support against the Yetzer hara of sexual excesses, as we might also say in the modern parlance, against the sexual libido. Their prayer was granted, and the Yetzer hara was handed over to them in their power. However, Prophet warned them, look out now. If you kill this one, the world will be destroyed. They tied him up for 3 days. This is a story that appears in Masechet Yoma. At the end of 3 days, when a fresh egg was needed for a sick person, they searched for one in all the land of Israel, but could not find a single one. What to do now was their problem. Should they kill him? They would destroy the world. Let us then ask that he be reduced to half the size, meaning that the sexual drive should be limited to marriage alone. Right? That's how the commentaries understand it. But no half things are granted by heaven, which is a kind of interesting idea in its own right. So they decide to blind his eyes, which helps somewhat to reduce his strength. There is in this tale an understanding of sexuality as a universal principle that serves life, as well as the interrelatedness and unity of all life forces. One has to accept the Yetzer hara in its universal reality, for without it, man could not maintain himself. He depends on nature's libido for his sustenance, but one cannot desire it for the life of nature and limit it only to certain forms of personal life. No half things are granted by heaven. One has to acknowledge the Yetzer hara and its wholeness of its universal function. Okay, so
where does this particular premise come from, that no half things are granted by heaven?
That's a good question.
Heaven could grant whatever it wants to
grant. Nachon. Nachon. That's a good question. I don't know the answer. Do you have a thought on it? I would have to look back at the sugya and see what the Rishonim said.
The person who wrote the story.
What?
Because it suited the person's argument.
No, but I think there has to be an idea. We don't just say. No, it's a Gemara in Yevamot, Yevamot 69b. But I would have to go back and look what the idea of the no half means.
I don't know if you're going to come to it or you want to take it now, but I don't know. Clearly, laying down these principles of sexuality, how you deal with it, leads to a whole of sniyut and shemagia and all the things, a whole corpus which the very Orthodox world keeps. Did he write? I mean, that's implicate. I mean, that's their response.
Well, he hasn't said yet what he thinks the idea is to be. He's going to say in a second. He doesn't. I don't think he's actually going to go that way. Right. Wait. Say your question.
I don't know how. Does he go into how one then copes with this segment of the Talmud? I understand the Talmud, except you know, it says that we have sexuality, but it can lead to very great dangers. And therefore,
okay, so we're going to get to the therefore. Let's get to his therefore, and then you can ask me the question again. Okay. What's going to be interesting is he's not going to go there.
Right.
He's not going to go there at all.
Yeah.
That's not to mean that I don't think he didn't.
That's pretty all I was asking.
Okay, so let's go to where he's going to go to. Let's get there. Hold on. Okay. So this is where we are right now. So if you look at the top of this next column where it says pleasure versus meaning seeking. However, just because sexuality is a universal life force, it surfaces in man originally as an impersonal drive. It is not what man does, but what is happening to man. One could very well, leave it at that, if man were nothing but nature, i.e. an animal, right? He understands that there's this drive, right? It's not that he's denying that. There is reason to assume that in the animal kingdom, sex is indeed utterly impersonal. I'm not sure if that's completely true, but it is not what an animal does, but something cosmic that enacts itself through the animal. Although the Talmud teaches there were all teachers were able to discern signs of personal and the sex acts of certain cases, even in the animal world. Right, that is true. There's a Gemara in Eruvin which talks about the way that animals court other animals. Right, that the rooster courts his mate, and so there's definitely some. It's not just a grabbing, but there is some courtship that goes on. But I'm not a scientist of animals in the personal. However, since the sexual instinct finds its normal satisfaction in union with a member of the other sex, this fundamentally impersonal drive points powerfully to another person. In the animal realm, it is essentially a pointing from genital to genital. In the human experience, it is a call from one biopsychic being to another. In other words, a call from person to person. True enough, just because man is not merely instinct, but also will, not only pleasure-seeking, but also meaning-pursuing, he may, if he so chooses, consciously attempt to reduce himself to the genital level of sexuality, and thus, instead of becoming a healthy animal, become a sick human being. But if he accepts himself in the fullness of his biopsychic reality, he will find that this most important impersonal drive of his nature directs him to the realm of the personal in the most fundamental of all human encounters. Okay, I hope you understood this. This is where he wants to go. He is saying there is this impersonal drive, the sexual drive, sexual desire, that can be very impersonal. Most people have it, and you could be attracted to anything or any person. But yet, to fulfill the act and to have sex is a very intimate thing that's very personal. And there's a tension between these two things. Because in the human experience, this most impersonal of all instincts demands its satisfaction with the most personal of interhuman relationships, what is biologically given loses its natural innocence and moral neutrality. In the context of the most intimately personal, the impersonality of the sexual impulse becomes, due to its incomparable energy and driving power, the most self-regarding and the most antisocial of impulses which man has to personalize. Because the sexual union is the most elementary of all interhuman encounters, in which the most impersonal instinct seeks its satisfaction in the most intimately interpersonal realm of human existence, the manner of its satisfaction cannot but faithfully determine the resolution of the conflicts as they arise when with the other self-regarding and antisocial impulses break into the interpersonal domain. It may therefore very well be that how man deals with personalizing the impersonal in his sex life is the core of all human morality. Okay, I'll try to say it outside. He thinks that this task is the task of what it means to be a human being and to have moral behavior. That you have this drive that's very impersonal and animalistic, but the drive leads you to encounter another human being. That encounter could be depending on how you relate to it, right? Obviously, it can be abused, and he's going to talk about that, be the most intimate connection to the other outside of you. And the question is, how do I make that move? How do I take this impersonal and turn it into the personal? And that, I think, is what he understands is the goal of human creation. And that is what he is going to be his goal of living in the image of the divine. And he's going to link it to the idea of just the way human being is going to see God, who is other and outside of him or her. That this sexual encounter is going to be similarly force us to relate to the other outside of us. If that made sense, and he's going to say it a bit more. And then we're going to analyze a rabbinic story, which I think is sort of the core of where he got this idea from and what he believes. So I'm on page, what page am I on?
Four.
Okay. It should be obvious by now that the fundamental principle of the sexual ethics that we have in mind is to personalize the impersonal. It is Jewish because it derives from the two presuppositions of the Jewish worldview that we indicated earlier, namely that the world is creation, meaning that God created the world, and that man is a biopsychic being, right, that is body and soul together, created in the image of the divine. We shall now attempt to develop in more detail the consequences that fall from the basic principle in light of the two presuppositions. What is the significance of the idea that the cosmos is creation in this context? We saw that the rabbis of the Talmud saw sexuality as a universal force that sustains the life of the world. Its function in nature is quite obviously procreation in its universality. So he says universally, with animals and everything, there's a basic function is to create life, to reproduce. Right, in some of the sections I skipped, he quotes the pasuk from Yeshayahu that the world was created to be inhabited, and that is the universal view. To personalize the impersonal sexual instincts is thus a twofold responsibility towards God and towards one's partner in the biopsychic encounter of the sexual union. However, on the level of the impersonal encounter, responsibility stems from the biblical commandment, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, which in the area of the God-man encounter receives the formulation, thou shalt love the eternal thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy might. Right? He's going to sort of create an idea of like what would be sex, l'shem shamayim, for this God meeting. Rather significantly, the rabbis in the Talmud interpreted the phrase with all thy heart to mean with both your inclinations, with the Yetzer Tov, the good inclination, and with the Yetzer Ra, the evil inclination. But we have seen earlier that they also identified the evil inclination with the libido. Indeed, through the personalization of the libido in its sexual manifestation by using it consciously in the service of a God-intended purpose, one loves God with one's whole heart and with one's Yetzer Hara. Of course, the sexual instinct is not the only manifestation of the Yetzer Hara. So this is what he's saying. By personalizing your sexual drive and you're doing a constant service of God, right, that is part of loving God. So how do I love God with my Yetzer Hara? It's through having a sex act that seems to manifest itself or represent the transcendence of what God wants me to do in the sex act.
Wait.
Yes.
When he says, indeed, through the personalization of the libido and its manifestation by using it consciously in the service of a God-intended purpose. What's a God-intended purpose? Is that just procreation?
So that's not going to be, he's not talking about procreation. It's going to be this idea of personalization. That's what I hope I'm going to be able to show it to you. Right? It's kind of seems kind of simple, but it's not in the sense of, he wants the idea of taking something that is a drive and turning it towards another human being and seeing actually that the other human being is also created in the image of the divine. And so like the capability of seeing the divine in the other, which is really what our experience of God is seeing the divine outside of ourselves. And so the sex act mirrors the I-God relationship. That's what he's going to try to say. I hope he'll say it better than I'm saying it so you can understand it. The truth that we affirm in the recognition of love as the originally given force in the wholeness of the biopsychic reality of man. It is the most fully personal, most truly personal, as the libido is the most truly impersonal. It is through love in the interpersonal encounter that the libido in its broadest meaning is redeemed from the prison of its impersonality. So this is the first time he's using the word love. He doesn't talk about it a lot here, but seemingly that's what love is the word he's talking about, to be the connection between the two people that is personal. The fully personalized sexual union is the fully humanized one. It relates one at the same time to the creator as well as to the fellow being in the wholeness of each other's humanity. What in nature is assumed to be purely biological is integrated into its humanized form into the biopsychic structure of man. However, since humanization implies also the acknowledgement of the divine purpose of the sexual function, the personalized and thus humanized sex act becomes a mitzvah, legalistically formulated a divine commandment in its existential quality, an ethical deed within the structure of a deocentric personal life. In fact, Talmudic texts occasionally call the sex act a devar mitzvah, a matter of mitzvah, not only in its God-relatedness, but also as what takes place in the interpersonal level between a man and a woman. Similarly, one might call an act of kindness and care for another human being a devar mitzvah. It is rather different a phrase from the four-letter word which designates the sex act in its biologically impersonal. I think that is what he's referring to, right? It was crazy to me when I got to that line, right? That the dvar mitzvah is very different from the four-letter word that on the street they refer to sex. And now we might say dehumanized form. As a dvar mitzvah, the biologically impersonal is transformed into human and personal. Jewish sexual ethics can perceive of the sexual act in its most humanized and personalized transformation as an act of sanctification. To sanctify oneself at the moment of intercourse is the ideal of sexual fulfillment. So this is what he does in this paragraph is very interesting, because the word dvar mitzvah is used about sexuality. And when you read the halachic text, it just means having intercourse for procreation. That's what it refers to. Or at least that's how the halakha understands it. He is saying something different here, from what I understand he's saying. He's saying that a mitzvah is a God-serving act, and that sexuality becomes sanctified through doing a dvar mitzvah, but that the mitzvah here is the creation of the relationship between the two people. Yes?
This is a serious question.
Yes.
If it's a dvar mitzvah, is there a bracha?
No.
I thought there was.
There are brachot that are said under the chuppah that like reveal to that. There, throughout Jewish history, at different times, there have been different types of like yehirat zones that actually have been written for that act.
Yeah.
Kabbalist like things like that, but there isn't a direct.
Except there's a bracha when you go to the bathroom.
Nachon, but I mean, like we give tzedakah and that's a mitzvah, and we don't say a bracha.
Okay.
We return lost objects and that. Nachon, a lot of mitzvot that we do between bein adam lechaverah, between other human beings, don't have brachas to them, right? When we acts that
like tzedakah,
right? Tzedakah doesn't, right? Meaning, I mean, I never thought about this. I'm thinking now on my feet. It's actually usually an act that is towards God. That in some way, because the act, maybe because of the disconnect to God, you have to like verbally state that this act has religious meaning, right? I could be tooting a horn, or I could be blowing a shofar, and there's no objective way to know in some ways. But when I verbalize and I focus, then I say. But I think part of what he's trying to say, when I'm relating to another human being, and I'm seeing you as another human being, whether it's to give you charity, or to return your lost object, or to have a sexual relationship with you, right? I am seeing the divine in you, and I'm relating to you, and in some ways, maybe, this is me making it up, he didn't say that, I'm only thinking on my feet, maybe there's something interesting about the fact that that doesn't have a bracha, because there's an intrinsicness to it that you realize that you're doing something that has meaning. Whereas the bracha is needed in places where you need that extra focus. But that's me talking, not my grandfather. And that was me just talking off the top of my head. So who knows what I was saying. The humanizing of the impersonal does not in any way take away from the enjoyment of the sexual act, right? It does not attempt to spiritualize the act. It wants what it says to humanize it, including also its full enjoyment within the biopsychic human reality. In fact, the enjoyment itself is part of the living realization of Judaism, right? In Talmudic times, the Talmud Chacham, a Jew who leads a life of piety informed by Jewish learning, would engage in the sexual act once a week, but it was customary to do so on the night of the Shabbat. Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki Rashi, the classical commentator on the Talmud who lived in the 11th century, explains the reason for the custom thus, quote, "It is the night of joy, of rest, being Shabbat, and of bodily pleasure. The context into which humanized sexuality is integrated brings about its joyous sanctification." So he understands that there is a drive. He understands that it is enjoyable and that Judaism wants that enjoyment. But for him, the religious act and what makes it act is this becoming personal and seeing the other person. Okay, he at this point in the article, he tells a Talmud story, and he spends quite a few pages analyzing the story. I'm going to read the story, and I think we can analyze it ourselves, because and if we don't, hopefully we'll say many of the ideas that he said, and if not, I'll add them. And I think that this story for him is the core of showing this idea that he's been trying to articulate. So I'll read the story out loud, and then you think about it as we're reading, and we can talk about how you understand it. This is a story that appears in Menachot 44a. The Talmud tells the story of a man who was extremely careful in the observance of the commandment of tzitzit, of wearing ritual fringes on the four corners of one's garb. Once he heard that there was a prostitute in a city by the sea whose fee was 400 gold pieces. He sent her the 400 gold pieces, and a time was arranged for him. When the day arrived, he went to the door of her house. Her maid went in and told her, "The man who sent you the 400 gold pieces has come and sits at the door." Said she, "Let him enter." He entered. She had prepared for him 7 beds, 6 of silver and 1 of gold. They arranged one above the other, and between each there was a ladder made of silver. The highest bed was the 1 of gold. She climbed up to the top and lay down naked in the golden bed. Then he too climbed up to sit down opposite her in the nude. At this moment, the tzitzit, the 4 fringes of his garb, came and slapped him across the face. I'm not sure, I don't think he was wearing them. I don't know if they floated up, or I don't know if he was naked except for the tzitzit, exactly. Maybe because he was so careful he kept them on, but he slapped him in the face. At this, he broke away and sat down on the ground, right? So he climbed down all those ladders. She came down too and sat on the ground. Said she to him, "By the capital of Rome, I shall not let you off until you tell me what blemish you saw in me." He said to her, "I swear I have never seen a woman as beautiful as you, but there is a commandment that God commanded us. Its name is tzitzit. The words in which they are written contain the phrase, 'I am the Lord your God,' twice, meaning I am the one who calls into account. I am the one who will reward. Now they, the tzitzit, appear to me as if they were the 4 witnesses." She said to him, "I shall not let you off till you tell me your name, the name of your city, of your rabbi, the name of your school where you study Torah." He wrote it all down and placed it into her hand. Then she got up and divided all her property into 3 parts, 1/3 for the government, 1/3 for the poor, 1/3 she took with her apart from the bed linen, which was not included in the division. I hope I said this. He's basically translating the story word for word. Like, this is how the story is presented. She proceeded to the study, right? So then, it's like a time break, it seems like. So she takes that note. She proceeded to the study house of Rabbi Chia and said to him, "Rabbi, command that I be made a convert." Said he to her, "My daughter, is it perhaps that one of the students appeals to your eyes?" She took the note that he had given her from her hand and gave it to him. Whereupon, after reading it, he said to her, "Go and take possession of what you have acquired." The story concludes with this moral. And so the same bed linen that she once spread out for him to serve his lust, she now spread out for him in consecrated union. This was the reward for the mitzvah of tzitzit in this world. How much more in the world to come, who can tell? Right, so that's the end of the Gemara. And then my grandfather proceeds for a number of stories to go line by line and break it down. But what do you think? What do you already know where he wants to go? What do you see in the story saying? You can't take the story.
I thought the tzitzit was very appropriate because, as I learned it, the reason you wear tzitzit, it says there are each ever it was a harathever kovet or show.
Exactly.
It refers to the situation. He doesn't quote that at all, so I find that puzzling.
This is the Gemara.
Why the Gemara uses the God's name, the God's name, the I'm the Buddha God twice is the reason why the tzitzit sort of slapped him in the face.
No,
why he stopped. Seems to me, well, I'm just finding it interesting, he didn't actually...
So what do people want to respond? Because my grandfather quotes exactly that. What the purpose of the tzitzit is that you should see them and you should not be, your eyes, you know, you should not be drawn your eyes and your desires.
I mean, according to your grandfather, he knows that he's going to a zona. And this is not a relationship, I gather. This is just a one-time thing. So that's what the tzitzit in his mind was supposed to remind him.
Well, I think it's...
She's the one who becomes, but she admires him so much.
So, wait, but let's, before we get to the her and him, I just want to keep on the tzitzit for a second, yes? So I think, right, the story opens by telling us, like, this is a man who is extremely careful about the observance of tzitzit, right? It seems clear that he knows that he has an issue, right? Meaning, why does he choose tzitzit to be the main one? Because he knows that he's look at it, right? Look how strong his lust is, right? This, what, is it just, did you want to say about how strong, what did you want to say, Jamie?
No,
you want to, about the climbing up and down. Okay, so, meaning, here's this woman, right? She's not a woman he sees on the street. He heard about her. She lives by the sea. She's far away. So he just hears this rumor of this incredible woman, and he's willing to send 400 gold pieces to go and make an appointment and travel to see her. Like, okay, that, first of all, that's totally impersonal, right? At that point, he has no idea who she is, what she looks, it's the fantasy of this woman, and he's already there. So it's clear, I think, that he knows he has some issue. He's struggling with the issue. So he takes tzitzit as his main one, although it doesn't seem like at first that he's able to overcome this issue, right? And so I definitely think you're right that the imagery, like, the story is subtle in the way it tells it. It doesn't quote us that pasuk. Sure. It knows we know that pasuk.
Right.
Okay? And it knows that he knows that pasuk, and that's why he's careful in the tzitzit. And he still, forget his eyes, it's just that he's hearing about this woman. And he sends them, right? This is a complicated process to find her and send the money and make the, right? Someone traveled there and sent the money, and someone traveled back and said, okay, come in such and such a day, and then he had to plan his trip, and then he goes there, right? Okay. Anything else you want to say, or I want to just try to do it sort of in the order that the story does, so we don't forget things. Yeah.
The thing is, you know, evidently, like you said, he knows he's got an issue, right? That he was willing to go through all this, blah blah blah, but he's so machbid on tzitzit. So, I think he's sort of. In my mind, he's still wearing his tzitzit when he climbs up all these ladders. Mm-hmm. And because you're climbing, you know, the tzitzit are flying around, and he gets to the top, and they hit him in the face, okay? Mm-hmm. And so I think that he sort of knows ahead of time that the tzitzit are going to keep him from going through with it. And that's why he's still wearing them, because he knows that nothing else can keep him from
could be.
Because he's got this...
He has some issues.
So much whatever, lust or
yes.
libido or whatever, so he can't... But he knows that the only thing that's going to keep him from actually transgressing is the tzitzit.
You're the story of Joseph.
I don't see at all that he knows he has an issue. I see that he has this irrepressible urge, this uncontrollable lust, and for a total stranger, and it's driven him to bizarre behavior.
Or extreme behavior. Extremes.
For him, you know, if you just looked at him in his normal life, you might call it bizarre. But okay,
yes.
Extreme behavior. And I think, actually, that this story is kind of like a polemic, if you will. Because in the end, what happens? Oh, the tzitzit saved him. And what was his reward?
He got to marry
this beautiful woman.
Well, I think the reason I thought that he knew is because the story opens with the idea that he's particularly machbid. He's very careful to do tzitzit, right? It tells us, like, he chose this as his extra special mitzvah, which to me a little bit hints. I don't, it's, you know, we're doing a literary analysis, that why that one? Why does he have to be careful of that? Like, why, right? It speaks to him in some way or connects to him personally in some way. That's why I thought that there was something. Right, so he's traveling far away, right? In the end, he has to sit at the door and wait for her. It's also a little bit demeaning, right? And at the beginning of the story, he is just, right, they call him the man who sent the 400 pieces, right? He has no name, he has no nothing, right? That's how and I'm curious if, like, he got duped as well, because, like, when he says the man who sent the 400 pieces, they know exactly who it is. Is that her fee? Or is it, like, he actually went for it and did it, right? And so...
That's just the ikmikdama.
That you think that's to get the appointment. I don't know what And so my grandfather has a great line. He said, what could be more impersonal than an appointment between lust and greed, right? So she's in it sounds like, for the money, and he's in it for the lust, right? And then, Jamie, did you want to say something about the beds? What did you want to say about?
Well, yeah. I want to say something about after, like when he's doing them.
Okay, so first, so then you show up, right, and she's like, she in some ways is a personification of the physical, of the material, right? The gold and the silver, and she's up on, you know, up there in heaven, and he's below looking up at her sprawled on the bed, right? And I don't know if there's significance to the sixth, and then the seventh one is different, is extra, right? Like this is this using the Shabbat imagery, but to show you like the pinnacle of it all, she's up there, right? And then suddenly he gets hit on the face, and then he comes down. So you want to say something about that now? Yes. Sorry. Yeah.
No, I don't know. No, I was just going to say that this is actually, I mean, maybe Elias Rubens is actually something that Jenny Rosenfeld from Efrat writes about this story, which is that like the important point, at least that she sees, is that he does go and sit on the ground instead of just leaving. He could have just left, but he then moves from like this. He then seems to care, like about explaining to her like what's going on, which is then moving from this like impersonal thing to like caring about the other person.
Yes. So that I'm sure she. I don't know what
she
read.
She may have read this.
I believe she probably did, but.
Maybe she quoted it there. That's just where I saw it.
Okay. No, I think it's the shot of the story, right? So he goes and he sits on the ground, right? And then she comes and she sits on the ground, right? And it's only at this point that they actually start to speak to each other, right? And the story says he says to her, she says to him, and they're talking. And she thinks he did this because he's rejecting her. And then this is the first time he says to her, I've never seen as beautiful a woman as you, right? Finally, he's seeing her as the woman and not as the rumor and as up on the bed. Like, she's now just a naked woman on the ground next to him, and he looks at her and sees her as a person, and they start to have a conversation. And when they start to have a conversation, she sees him also for who he is, and he starts teaching her some Torah. He quotes the pasuk. He says the tzitzit. Right? He doesn't hide who he is as a right. He explains to her, that's a lovely way to put it, of really what's going on. He doesn't just run out embarrassed, and then she says, I want to know your name and your city and your rabbi and your school where you learn Torah. Like, she gets who he is. She understands he's a Ben Torah. And she wants to know those specifics of his identity, right? This is where, when they're on the ground, naked, finally talking to each other and seeing each other as people and not involved in their either greed or lust, then they find, you know, she gets the core of who he really is underneath this sexual drive. And my grandfather he finds it very significant that instead of just saying, like, I'm the student of Rabbi Chiya, I learn here, that he writes it down for her and he places it in her hand. As if to say, my grandfather understands it, like, this is who I am, guard it, keep it safe. I'm handing you something, cherish it. You know, I'm giving you this piece of who I am, and I want you to have a piece of who I am. But the piece of who I am is my name and where I learn, and that's who I am. And then seemingly he leaves. He doesn't know what's gonna happen, right? And then she is so enamored, I guess, by who he is as a person, when he sees really right who he is, that she gives up some of her wealth, right? She gives to the poor, she gives to the government, not completely, like, it's also not like, you know, she doesn't have to be destitute, she keeps a third of it, she probably is quite wealthy, right? And she also takes these bed linens, right, that they haven't yet slept on, but that were the sort of her physical other reminder of this experience that they had. And she goes to Rabbi Chiya, And she makes this very strong statement that she wants to convert, which is kind of also interesting because the story didn't tell us that he said, I'm only going to... I mean, she understood from who he was that Judaism was the core central aspect and Torah was the core central aspect of who he was. We did our discussion on conversion, but Rabbi Chiya seems to immediately say, is it that you are, right, did you have an eye for one of my students, right? So we're back to this thing like, are your eyes leading you to certain desires, right? Definitely this imagery of the tzitzit was part of the story, right? And so instead of verbally saying, she hands him the note again, and she entrusts him with it. Right, and so then he sees, I don't know if he recognizes his student's handwriting, but he understands that there was an encounter between these two people, but that was a meeting of understanding of who the student is about, that he's a teacher of Torah. And then he says this crazy line that doesn't sound romantic at all, sounds very, right, go and take possession of what you have acquired. Right, so that sounds like back in that same business transaction, you know, he got paid money and there's an acquisition, but yet, so my grandfather takes it as this sort of taking the flip on, like putting a flip on this, on it being just a business transaction, and yet so he uses this language to show the juxtaposition that he understands that they've built something together. The acquisition is this relationship. Give me one more second. And that that in recovering their personal dignity and understanding who one another is, they have built something that is worthy of being together. Mm-hmm. And he allows her, presumably he converts her. It doesn't exactly say that. He says, you know, go.
Well,
He must have. Right?
I think this proves that it's okay to convert for marriage.
Yeah, there are many other cases of that. This is a good example of one. And then, on the one hand, they developed from their step, but on the other hand, they're still connected to their past, because then she uses the same bed linens, right? And this is all part of the same story, and this is the reward for wearing mitzvah, for wearing tzitzit.
I was
yes.
just saying, the one class of yours I missed was the conversion class.
You can listen to it online.
I think this is the first quarter of an hour.
But it's hard,
and
I know.
I got distracted. I say what was said over there. It seems to me this is to the bottom mind, or the words we used to come to the idea that you can overtly say you are married, you want to convert because you found something you want to marry, seems to me not to be less acceptable. But also, they don't say go and learn for 3 years. And he said, yeah, okay, you've acquired it.
Go get it.
I convert you. So, I mean, this is a Talmud exhaust, presumably.
100% is a Talmud.
Why don't the rabbis quote this?
To a dead end in halakhic terms.
It didn't completely lead to a dead end. There are many responses in Tshuvot about being able to marry for marriage, and that is something that has happened throughout Jewish history from the time period of the Amoraim till the modern day. Such phenomena have happened. It is true that part of what I talked about in the conversion class, and I encourage you even to just take the download the sheets and read them, or read it, take the books out of the library and read my grandfather himself, and not my intervention. But his main point was to try, as you see from a lot of his work, is to go back to the original sources and see what the possibilities that are open within the halakha, and trying to make an argument that sometimes there's too narrow an interpretation of halakha. And so clearly this would be one type of example to support that idea that we can have a more open view to conversion. Yes.
Okay, so this is really a leap because we don't have the Hebrew in front of us, and
yes.
I wouldn't recognize it in the Torah anyway. Okay, go and take possession of what you have acquired. So it reminds me of Sarah and Abraham leaving Haran and taking with them the souls, and the language is clear, the souls they had acquired.
Mm-hmm.
Very peculiar word to use, and a peculiar word here. So with Sarah and Abraham, it's not understood to be slaves, you know, that you acquired them, but the people who were drawn to you by your way of life and who became converts in a way,
yes.
followers of yours in a way, because of who you were and what they saw.
I would have to go look at the Hebrew and compare the two. I hadn't thought of that. I was thinking of acquired more, and McGriff there takes it more of like that they were doing a business transaction beforehand and using that language. I also think acquiring is a language that's used normally actually for, right, Haishani Knate, it's the woman who is acquired in the Marriage Act. Here she's actively acquired. But your idea is also very lovely, so we'll have to go look. You can look as well. Menachot 44a, look at the story, compare it. We'll go home and do more Torah learning after.
Well, the Midrash says Abraham and Sarah, they converted them. These are the people who they brought into the basic Judaism.
Yes. So I we'd have to connect the language. We'd have to see if the language connects.
But
okay.
It's a turnaround. You know, the language of marriage in the Talmud is Isha Niknit, and now it's exactly the opposite. She's
taking what she's right, what she has acquired. Yes.
He's being acquired, and she's the acquirer. Right.
So he uses the story as presenting, in his view, this theme that he's been trying to argue for. I mean, I think the story is part of what built the theme, right? Is that Jewish sexuality isn't just based on the lust, right? That's what we have to guard against. But sexual attraction is good and pleasure is good, but you have to see the other person for who they are and know them and see them as another human being. And it's only when you're on that like ground level, right, just on the dirt floor in your birthday suit and having a conversation, that's when relationships are built, and that is this making the impersonal personal. Clearly, this idea. He's going to quote Avraham right now, but this is a number of pages later. The idea of marriage. He understands like that is the goal of sexuality for him, and that it also is not just a personal thing, but it has meaning within history. Judaism is a process through history, beginning with Abraham the father, moving towards the culmination in Abraham's child, the Messiah, when all history will be fully redeemed from the bondage of the impersonal. Because in history, Judaism is forever striving for its realization, it is always lived with a sense of the not yet. It is forever lived in the future and with responsibility towards that future. It is what it will be yet be. A Jew who desires to be one is always a link in the generations, a child that receives and the parent that transmits with the intention and freely accepted responsibility, affirming through time the bringing about at the end of time that God had spoken of Abraham. Personalization of the union between a man and a woman is to be sought on the interpersonal level, in the presence of God, with the acceptance of the responsibility for the historic destiny of all of Israel. That is what Jewish ethics means by marriage and family. That is what we mean by the marriage formula. Thou shalt be sanctified unto me according to the law of Moses and Israel. So everything that he has been saying is about between me and another human being is also going to be a reflection of me and God, but me and another human being as being part of this link in between this playing out of Jewish history throughout. And so the sanctification I create in my personal relationship is part of the destiny of the Jewish people. Because the importance of the interpersonal and that the laws of how we are seeing another human being, he does spend some time in his article. The halacha that he chooses to talk about is about the correct behavior within a sexual relationship. And he says, I'm on page 6, the words of the Bible, thou shalt not go astray after thy own eyes and after thy own hearts, right? That's the quote from the Tzitzit Psukim, were interpreted a generation earlier by Rav's teacher, Rav Yehuda the Prince, Rav Yehuda Nasi, editor of the Mishnah, as including the wording, a man shall not drink from one cup while setting an eye on another. Several generations later, another teacher in Talmud applied this not only to a case where a man is intimate with his wife while thinking of a strange woman, but even in a case of polygamy where a man is thinking of another one of his wives. Another Talmudic teacher, Rav Asi, taught that a man is forbidden to compel his wife to have intercourse. Right? So what's very interesting in what he's trying to show here is that within this relationship, right, to really have it be personalized, is not just the love aspect, but about how one's treating the other person in the relationship. So the idea that you shouldn't think of another person is, we can understand that if it's someone outside the relationship. But what's very, very interesting, and he's going to re-mention this, is that at it, Jewish halakha allows a man to have more than one wife. Thankfully, we have Takanat Rabbeinu Gershom, we don't do that anymore. But what's interesting about this halakha, because I think it gets to the core of the idea of what he's trying to say is, right, I can have a relationship which is permitted to me. I can have one wife, two wives, three, they're all, right, none of those are forbidden relationships. So you might have thought, what should be the problem with me being with wife number one and thinking about wife number two, right? That's different than me thinking of a woman outside the relationship. But the halakha says that that is not appropriate. And it seems to be because at the moment of the intimacy with wife number one, I should be fully present and see her for her and not be thinking of someone else, even if it's a permitted relationship. And that, to him, is part of the focus on that seeing the other person in the moment of the act. The second thing that is quite... Right, the rabbis have a lot of negative things about women, but here's a pretty good one that is extremely afar. I don't say this lightly because in the modern day there were countries and even states, I believe, in America till quite recently did the thought that marital rape was permitted, but the rabbis were against such a thing, which is an extremely important thing. Rav Asi taught that a man is forbidden to compel his wife to have intercourse. Others before him had already enjoined that a man should be extremely considerate in intimacy with his wife. He should be aware of her needs. She should please her before the intercourse. He should communicate with her before the act and even during it, bring joy to her. In a striking passage, Rabbi Levi, also of the second century, gave the rather surprising interpretation of the following words of God through the prophet Ezekiel. And I will purge out from among you the rebels and them that transgressed against me by saying, these are the people who compel their wives into intercourse, who are intimate with their wives even though they hate them, who quarrel with them and when they are together, who have sexual relationships while drunk, who engage in the sex act even though they have already divorced their wives in their hearts. The medieval commentaries explain this passage with particular reference to the drunk. One says his sex act is not a true union, but an act of prostitution, for he's bent only on the act itself. Another says because of his drunkenness, he does not consider his wife at all. Here too, this is, I think, these ideas emphasize the point that he's trying to make. Meaning, like, what should it matter? Two people are married, they're consenting adults, so they have sex when they're drunk. Like, why should that be an act of rebelliousness against God? But what's very interesting, he quotes two of the commentaries, there are other commentaries, right? Ravad says there's a lack of love there, right? If you're not conscious and you're, right, when you're drunk, you're not present. Right, you're doing it and you're getting the pleasure, but that personal aspect is lacking. And so there too, even in a permitted relationship, right, that is not something, a behavior we want. Because we want, although we want there to be pleasure in the related sex act, we want you to be present and to be with the other person and to see the other person and to have some connection to the other person. Because of the nature of the relationship between man and woman, all these rules of sexual behavior are enjoined on the husband. But there are also some statements which speak of the conduct of the wife in the sex act. For example, our masters say, when a woman lies with her husband and thinks of a man who she saw on the road, there is no greater lewdness than that. The very strong phrasing is an indication that from the point of view of the most intimate interpersonal relationships, this would be considered a worse denigration of its moral character than even the act of outright sexual unfaithfulness. All these rules and principles of behavior have one thing in common. They all aim at the elimination of the impersonal form of the sexual union and its consecration through personalization. They are equally binding on both sexes. They are directed against using another person as a sex object. In accordance with the Talmudic methodology, the rules are usually derived from or homologically related to some verse in the Bible. Most impressive, however, is the statement of Rabbi Levi, who, as we saw, applied the terms of rebels and transgressors against God to people who denigrate the satisfaction of their sensual desires to the level of the holy and personal. It is considered rebellion and transgression against God. This is in keeping with our main thesis. Personalization includes relatedness to the divine purpose. Sex indulged on the impersonal level is not only a degradation of one's sex partner, but also a rejection of what God intended sex to be. Yes?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you only gave us parts, so I don't know if maybe he talks about this somewhere else, but, you know, he keeps talking about personalization, and he actually did mention love a couple of times there, and
yep.
Etc. But does he have, you know, love and personalization of sex can be not only in the context of marriage. Does he talk about premarital
not directly. He does spend a bit more time talking about marriage. I had to choose which parts to say, and I want to try to finish within the next 5 minutes. So, but his main point that he says about marriage, I don't think I brought it in his quote, and I encourage you always to read the full article, is that he thinks that the ultimate commitment to the personal is a structure of marriage where there is a commitment. And that you're not, meaning, how do I make sure that I'm not just doing this for the pleasure and that I want to put effort into the personal relationship? He sees that is affected by the publicness of a statement of a commitment of marriage. And he does talk about that. So he doesn't outright like say what he's talking against, but that's his argument too. You could argue against it possibly, but there is something to it to a certain extent of the sticking with the ups and the downs to make sure you work on the personal because you made a public commitment statement, right? And he talks about the fact that you might be able to get married without the public commitment and why we think that there is, right, all you need is two witnesses, but why we make sure it's public, et cetera. So he does have a focus on that in the article. I just want to say two quick things before we end. He has one small paragraph about birth control because he needs to address such a thing. And he knows that there are people who are childless and who cannot have children, right? And so he wants to say, because he has mentioned the part of the God Act is to reproduce, but the importance of the permissibility of birth control supports his thesis that there's another side to the sex act, which is the personal. The few words have yet to be said on the question of birth control. Does our presentation not exclude it completely? This is not the place to give a comprehensive or even somewhat adequate discussion of the subject. It should be stated, however, that Jewish sexual ethics does not insist that the sex act always be directed towards procreation. If that were so, marriage could not continue beyond a wife's childbearing age. Marriage to a woman who is not fertile would then be against Jewish law, which obviously it's not. While at one time such a marriage was to be dissolved after 10 years, custom is, as explicitly stated in the Shulchan Aruch, no longer to be observed. Cases of actual birth control permitted or even required are discussed in the Talmud and ruled upon in the codes. Special cases of rape, of threat to the health of the mother, and numerous others have been discussed in the rich responsorial literature over the ages. I actually think that sentence is even referring to abortion and not specifically birth control, because cases of rape, what? Yeah, it has to be. He doesn't say that word outright. I don't know, maybe it was too touchy, but in those cases, Judaism would be fine with abortion. It is not the intention of our presentation to give rulings in the specific cases. What we should bear in mind is that whenever birth control is permissible or even mandatory, or when certain unions, even though childless, is yet to be maintained, what then falls in practice is just because it is done in the light of the teaching of Torah, still an act of personal relatedness to God, the creator of life. Because the question was originally asked of Judaism, one acts then with full awareness as one responsibility towards the divine purpose and seeks its realization through us. And so he thinks that by having this act of connectedness, you're still seeking God in your sexual act. He says at the very end, he says, Jews today disagree as to what extent Judaism requires of them that they adhere to the interpretation of halakha as promulgated by one or the other trend within Judaism. I think he means denominations. It seems to us, however, indisputable, I'm on top of seven, that anyone who desires to live his life as a Jew will have to adopt a sexual ethics whose goal it must be to personalize his sexual relationship on the threefold level that we have indicated. The impersonal as between man and woman, the cosmic as between God and man, and the historic as between the individual Jew and the destiny of the Jewish people throughout the ages. And so those are the focuses of what you need to think about. Of a union, right? He goes on. I actually accidentally skipped a line there. I want to say one last thing. We won't have time. I encourage you to read these sections here on from God, Man, and History. But one of the main things in God, Man, and History is talking about what is a mitzvah. And he talks about that the fact that they're always the same thing. There has to be a link between what the body and the mind. Right? That's why so many of the mitzvot are actual physical ritual actions. They're not about belief. Because we have to, that a human being can't be separated between the human's physical body and the mind. The same exact thing that he was saying with sexuality. And that is how we ultimately can serve God. We'll say maybe I could read you one line of it. If you look on the last page, and then we'll end with this. Maybe I'll read, you'll give me the 3 seconds to read both of these paragraphs, and we'll end with this. It says, the vindication of the matter itself is essentially a religious task, is the part of the basic religious obligation which we have described as imitatio Dei, right, how we imitate God. The original religious experience is man's encounter with the divine. In this encounter, we discern God's care and concern for man. From this follows the religious duty to meet the other as God meets man with care and concern. Now, one of the most elementary meetings with the other is the confrontation between man's conscious self and his material condition. The body does not meet the spirit, but the spirit does meet the body. Whatever the distance between the two, it is nothing when compared to the abyss that originally separates man from God. Notwithstanding God's nature as holy other, the love and piety of God for man allows the encounter to take place. How much more should the spirit of man, an imitation of God, meet the body with pity and care? The rejection of man's physical nature is an act of irreligion. It is conceit of the spirit and irreverence towards God's creation. While such rejection may occasionally be acclaimed as the unnatural triumphant of rare individuals, in the history of man, it always leads to undoing of the spirit by the vengeance of the neglected drives of human nature. That was hard language, but what he's saying is, if you try to deny the spirit, the physical, right, like if you try to limit your sexual drive or whatever, you'd be neglecting your human nature and you'd be denying the spirit of God. For the soul to meet the body of man, it should become the helpmate of the body, directing its impulses towards an acknowledged goal that is acceptable to those needs as well. It should work for the dedication in such a way that they may find fulfillment and at the same time perform the bidding of God. When matter becomes vindicated in this way and the harmonization of human nature is thus accomplished, the soul of man has made its insights available for the guidance of the body, and the body of man has lent its vital effectiveness to the aspirations of the soul. Through their union in the mitzvah, the great transformation takes place. The spirit becomes materialized and therefore effective. The body is spiritualized and thus oriented towards the divine. This is holiness. The spirit is never holy by itself. There is no holy ideals or holy intention. Holiness is only possible where the danger of profanity is close at hand. Only in the realm of defilement may the act of sanctification be performed. The encounter between the spirit and the other is the origin of holiness. Holiness may evolve only when the spirit is in contact with the opposite. When the ideal begins to penetrate the kingdom of the material, there is the beginning of sanctification. When natural needs and urges become directed towards goals which may be acknowledged in the presence of God, and where the spiritual aspirations become affected through their communion with the material sources of vitality, there alone may holiness be found. Only life is capable of holiness. An aesthetic rejection of the world of senses excludes the possibility of sanctification. It is not the will that is holy, but the deed. Because in it the spiritual and material unite, and through the holy deed alone, that body as well as soul may be sanctified. So that was very intense, I know, but what I wanted you to see is that this idea is all part of his general philosophy of what the human body does and what the service of God is. And that it is only by taking our bodily instincts and sanctifying them. And the way he's talking about sanctifying sexuality, I think, is by thinking about the other person and the personalized and seeing the other person as a person. And that is what elevates it into understanding the other person as the object of the divine. I don't have time to talk about it, but what's interesting about the laws of Snood and whatever, it's is very impersonal. Yeah. It just sees the other person as a sex object, and I have to stay away from them and doesn't think of them as another person. He doesn't directly address it. It's not that he thinks that you shouldn't have Snood, but I think that possibly taking this philosophy to an end might lead to a different way of controlling one's sexual urges, or of relating to other human beings as human beings and not as sex objects, and trying to control through that vehicle, therefore control your sexual desire. And it would lead to a completely different outcome that I think would be very important and relevant in our day.
Very helpful.
So I encourage you, as always, to read everything in full. That was only a small little excerpt from God, Men, and History. I once actually asked my grandfather what he thought, like, his most important, or I don't exactly remember how I phrased it, his best work or most important work. He actually answered God, Men, and History, and we've read very little of it over the course of our time together. So of all the works, I also encourage you to really look at that one, because in his mind, that was his most important work, right? I think it clearly, those are the main themes. The relationship between God, what a human being is, and how that plays out in Jewish history, I think are the themes that we've seen running throughout all his works of his understanding in halacha. We have one last meeting, if you're going to make it with me till next week, and somewhat of a completely different topic, the idea of prayer. My grandfather wrote a very, very small book entitled Prayer, all about prayer, and so we're going to look at that. How can human beings pray? Does God listen to prayer? Are prayers answered? What is the purpose of Jewish prayer? And that will be our last session together next week.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.